All right. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm so excited today because we get to talk to, I would say she's famous within the functional medicine community, but Dr. Carrie Jones is with us and particularly famous for hormones. And so today we're going to dive into menopause. So I'm just going to give you a little background on Dr. Jones. So she's a naturopathic physician who also has a master's in public health and is an internationally recognized speaker, consultant, educator on the topic of women's health and hormones. Dr. Jones graduated from National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon, and then completed a two-year residency in women's health, hormones, and endocrinology. She also later graduated from Grand Canyon University's Master of Public Health program and one of the first to become board certified through the American Board of Naturopathic Endocrinology, and currently serves on that board. She was the medical director for the Dutch test with Precision Analytical for several years and is a clinical expert for the SOS Stress Recovery Program for Lifestyle Matrix Resource Center and is currently on the Under Armour Council of Human Performance and currently serves as the head of medical education at Rupa Health. So welcome, Dr. Jones. And she is also a podcaster. So she has a podcast called Root Cause Medicine. So we'll make sure that we link that in the show notes as well. So welcome to the podcast today. And just to kick it off, why don't you tell us, so I know you focus a lot on women's health and hormones, and certainly menopause is a big topic when women are approaching that age. So tell us a little bit about what menopause is and at what symptoms that people may be experiencing, what's happening at this time.
It can feel like chaos. It can feel like chaos for a lot of women, right? So first of all, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it and love always talking about hormones, especially for women who are perimenopausal and menopausal, because I feel as we get away from our 20s and 30s, not much education goes out there with our OBGYN or our primary care or really anything in school. We were taught years ago how to either get or avoid being pregnant. And beyond that, it was like, best of luck. Things changes are going to happen, but we're not going to talk about it. And I found through the years that a lot of my patients would hit their 40s and go, what is happening to me? Not, I haven't changed anything. I didn't change my habits. I haven't changed my diet. I haven't changed my exercise routine. I take the same supplements and medications, but yet I feel all these crazy symptoms. So my periods are starting to change. They're getting shorter, or they're getting longer. They're coming more often, or they're skipping months. I'm having some more hot flashes and night sweats. My temperature regulation is off. I'm noticing my brain function isn't as swift and sharp as it used to be. I can't remember words. I go into a room. I've lost my keys, which is so not like me. And people start to notice the sort of systemic physical symptoms. My joints are a little more achy, and my libido has definitely gone away, and my hair is starting to feel dry and brittle. What is happening? Welcome to perimenopause. Perimenopause is the transition into full menopause. So full menopause is when you go 12 months with no period, so no menstrual cycle, you age related. So if you're listening to this and you're like, I'm 24 and I haven't had a period in 12 months, different. That's not menopause. Menopause is when we sort
of...
Exactly. But if you were in your 40s and 50s and you haven't had a period in 12 months, then that's the definition. Once you hit the 13th month of no period, you are considered menopausal. It doesn't mean the symptoms go away. Sadly, they don't go hand in hand. But that is the classical definition. So we have the transition period, perimenopause, and then no period, and that's menopause.
And we also have that group that's surgically put into menopause by a hysterectomy and removal of the ovaries. And that's a whole other situation as well.
That's
you don't get quite the slow transition.
Yes. Yeah. Those women I feel so bad for, because I would have patients say, okay, I'm having my hysterectomy complete, right? Ovaries as well, which is what puts you into full surgical menopause. And I'd say, okay, just be aware, when you wake up from surgery, the minute the ovaries are removed, you are considered menopausal. The second. It's not a slow decline. It's not like you get a month or a week or maybe through the weekend immediate. So when you wake up from surgery, you are going to be considered menopausal. And it's so unfair and so unfortunate, even in a necessary situation. I'm not against a full hysterectomy. Sure. If you need it, get it. But I don't think the education is there, where sometimes they are left with nothing. Sometimes they have an estrogen patch slapped on them and they're like, go follow up with your OBGYN. And sometimes, you know, it can be just awful. And I wish more education was out there for them as well.
Sure, because I think that population too, I think traditional, like you said, the OBGYNs will prescribe an estrogen patch, but then like all the benefits of progesterone, if you're talking to a 30-year-old person, it's okay, like I know you don't have a uterus anymore, so we don't need to protect the endometrial lining, but there's so many other things that progesterone does in the body that, and I realize there's probably a lack of evidence and use in that population from a large study group population, but it's definitely conversations that are worth having with people's providers for sure.
I agree.
Yeah. So as far as those symptoms, and from my background, I see a lot of like metabolic patients with diabetes. And in this menopausal period, they start to have, because of this decrease in estrogen, they start to have a rise in their blood sugars. So we see more weight gain, like you said, like the foods that they were eating, like aren't working anymore. The diet that they were doing or the nutrition program, exercise program that they were doing isn't working anymore. So that can become a challenge. But what do you recommend nutrition wise for this group of people? And we'll get into HRT or hormone replacement in a minute, but what is like, is there research around what's the best diet? I know we have a million different diet options. I was just talking to my students this morning about the keto diet and how that's probably not long standing, or like as far as keeping it for forever, it's probably not sustainable. But what do you see, or what do you recommend to your patients that are like, okay, what do I eat and how do I improve my nutrition at this point?
And there's two categories for this. There's the person who never had to worry about their weight, and so they literally ate whatever they wanted most of their life. And now as they head into menopause, they are noticing they cannot get away with the junk, the snacking, their choices when it comes to their metabolic health or the like that visceral body fat that they're putting on around the middle, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So for them, I'm like, hey, it's a real wake-up call. The choices that you're making, with either the fried, the fast, the high sugar, the processed, the chemical additives, like we have to really clean that up. So that's one camp where we have to start with sort of the basics of nutrition. Now there's another camp who are already really pretty educated. They definitely do generally eat a clean diet. They tend to lean towards vegetables. They eat their protein. But what I'm finding, and what I've learned a lot from another doctor, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, is that as we get older, we need a whole lot more protein. In fact, Dr. Stacey Sims, who's a researcher, women's health researcher, she talks about this all the time as well. As we get older, our protein need goes up. And what I would find in practice is that camp of women tended to eat quote unquote cleaner. They didn't eat enough. They were having a salad with a little bit of chicken on top and thinking, I got my vegetables and some protein. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we need to get a little more substance in there. We probably need to double, if not triple, the protein, depending on how much you've got. And then being aware of timing of foods, especially because sometimes we think we're eating really clean, but we end up finding that we're actually really snacking all the time. We're constantly grabbing and nibbling and noshing, sipping and drinking, like all through the day, which can affect our blood sugar and insulin, of course. And then we get into perimenopause and menopause, which makes us more unstable in the metabolic area and more prone to things like prediabetes, diabetes, insulin resistance, etc. And so it really is truly, I find for a lot of women, is like, let's evaluate the facts. What are you actually eating? How often are you actually eating it? Not what you think, but let's be real about this. Coupled with things we don't even think about, alcohol intake. Women will say, oh, I don't drink that often. But when they actually look at their intake over a week or even a month, they find, oh my gosh, I'm actually drinking a lot more alcohol than I thought. Or coffee drinks. How often do you drink coffee drinks? Oh, not that often. But then they realize they're picking up a fancy sugar-filled, foam-topped coffee drink 4 or 5 times a week. And so by really truthfully looking at the facts to help evaluate. But I will go back to what Dr. Lyon and Dr. Sims say, is that I think as women get older, our protein need for sure goes up. I, for one, I'm in my 40s. I have drastically increased my protein intake. I thought I ate a lot of protein before. I was wrong when I did the math and really looked at my foods. And by just increasing my protein, however that looked, has made a massive difference in my energy, in my cravings or my hunger or just my body in general. Sure. And so while I know there are a lot of diets out there, there's everything from vegan, vegetarian, all the way up to paleo and carnivore. I find that
The people eating only meat.
Oh my gosh, only meat. Exactly. And in some cases, they have a place or they have a timeline, depending what's going on in your body. But I do agree more protein is better. I do agree we have to be very mindful of the snacking, the alcohol, the sugar,
sure,
the coffee drinks. So I try to take it back to those basics as opposed to saying, oh my gosh, everybody needs paleo once they hit perimenopause. Maybe, but maybe not. Sure. Maybe it's not what works for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe if you're autoimmune or have gut dysfunction and there's other things layered on top of that, and some of those other more specific diets, maybe, or templates, I guess we could say. What are your thoughts on intermittent fasting in this population? Because I go back to a lot of, at least what I've looked at, a lot of these patients in these studies are men in intermittent fasting data. But then also we have these other studies that throw me off because they're like the nurse, I think it was a nurse's health study where skipping breakfast decreased their GLP-1 response at lunch and actually made them have higher glucose levels at lunch. And like, how do you balance that conversation? Because I do see some women that it works for, but then other women that it doesn't seem to make a difference. Because I have people with diabetes tell me all the time, oh, I never eat breakfast. And I'm just like, if all these people aren't eating breakfast, clearly this intermittent fasting thing isn't working. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not against it at all. And in fact, two of the big women's health intermittent fasting experts, Dr. Mindy Pels and then Cynthia Thurlow, were good friends of mine. And so I love hearing what they do with their thousands of women as they're leading them through these protocols. And of course, Cynthia and Mindy are also both menopausal. And so they have a lot of personal experience as well and can lead groups through that. So I agree with you. I have a lot of women that comment or DM me that say that in this transition, they have decided to work with intermittent fasting because they used to eat all day long from the time they got up to the time they went to bed when they were watching Netflix at night and snacking all night long. And when they implemented intermittent fasting, it really helped them get control over their eating window. Because, of course, intermittent fasting doesn't necessarily mean you lower your calorie intake. It's just you shorten your eating window so you have a longer time where you don't eat. And for a lot of women, they would say, oh my gosh, that was very helpful for me to see how often was I snacking? Why constantly reaching for something, the cravings that I had. So it really actually made them more aware of their body. Whereas others thought that intermittent fasting was too much, too hard, maybe with cortisol response, maybe the stress in their life, maybe gut health, that when they would try to ease into intermittent fasting, or though some women just jump right into it and go 16 hours, do the 16-8 plan, and they're like, I felt horrible. I'm like, maybe we should ease into that and start with 12. 12-12. And so then in that case, I'm like, let's evaluate what else is going on. How is your cortisol? How is your thyroid? How is your gut health?
Yeah.
And so I agree with you. I'm all for it if it's gonna work. If somebody says I'd like to try it, I'm like, fantastic. I recommend you pick up Mindy's book or Cynthia's book and don't do it blindly. And if it doesn't work, don't give up hope. There's probably other reasons, and let's address that.
Yeah, we can link those books in the show notes too. Yeah, I think that's interesting because I feel like in a perfect world, intermittent fasting would really skip dinner instead of breakfast. But our American society is dinner is our family time. So it's really hard. So I think in Europe, it might be easier because they have that. Obviously, they're becoming a little westernized too with the schedule. But in general, they still have their bigger meal at lunchtime. So I think that might make it easier because then you just have a cup of tea or something as when you get home and not have to feel like you need to get all of your calories. But yeah, so super interesting. And I'll have to read those books myself as I start to help more people in that age range. But as far as HRT, so let's talk about, I am completing my fellowship with A4M and doing a lot of that includes the endocrine module specifically focused on hormones and hormone replacement therapy. And the more I learn about the role of estrogen and progesterone, I'm like, oh my goodness, as soon as I'm like low, I need to get this, right? but then we have modern medicine that's like, no, we only give this for certain situations, or we have this past study with the Women's Health Initiative that's almost screwed the current generation of, you know, women that were not as educated from the provider level because we were taught this information. So tell us a little bit about that and what the problems were with that study and where we are now with hormone replacement therapy.
Oh my goodness. The Women's Health Initiative, the WHI. So the WHI came out to evaluate estrogen and progestin, which is not progesterone, but progestin, from a few different angles. So they had a group that was estrogen only, and they had a group that was the estrogen progestin. So essentially the brand name of the medication was Prempro and Provera. And so many women were on this for menopause to help their brain, their bones, their symptoms, their sex life, etc. So the Women's Health Initiative came out and it made front headlines all over the world, essentially, that said these hormones cause breast cancer, including other things. It affected negatively affected your brain, negatively affected your colon, plus others. And so hormone replacement therapy came to a screeching halt. And women who were doing really well on it were all of a sudden yanked off of it, plunged into worse symptoms, and it became a nightmare. Since that time, a lot of drama. It should be a, I don't, is it a documentary? It should be a mini series. If it isn't yet, and I've just missed it. Turns out the Women's Health Initiative, when you read the story behind the authors, when they signed off on it, it's even things like they were put in a room and they were forced to sign off on the study and the outcomes. And many of the authors disagreed with it. And it was like, you don't have a choice. We're publishing, it's going to the paper in 10 minutes. Or, you know, if your name has to be on this paper, you have to sign off on this. All the way to so many retractions. A lot of authors have gone on to do additional studies, additional follow-ups. And while it never made the news, not ever, you will read follow-up studies by various authors who were on the original study. And they basically, without saying, oops, that was a mistake, that's actually not true, what came out of the Women's Health Initiative. Sure. And the Women's Health Initiative itself had a really poor design. It was older women, a lot of metabolic conditions, smokers, that increased the risk for some of the outcomes that they found in the Women's Health Initiative already. And they excluded women who, they were very careful in who they included to get the outcome that they wanted. It's for some of their studies on like hot flashes or quality of life. Mm-hmm. There are a few branches of the Women's Health Initiative. Cancer was not the only outcome they looked at. So they were very careful to exclude women who would skew the results or make it seem better than it actually was, which we all found out a decade later, unfortunately.
Sure. Yeah.
And so when you read the studies, even the estrogen that they used, the Premarin that they used, didn't raise breast cancer at all. I mean, just it was just wild when you just estrogen by itself is not the issue. But as a result, because of the news and because everyone now who goes to a pharmacy, if you get any type of estrogen product, and if you just get bioidentical progesterone, which is Prometrium from the pharmacy, or you get the insert, the package insert, and it's like, oh, because of the WHI, this is going to cause cancer. So good luck. And then my patients freak out. The insert says it causes cancer. I'm like, oh, we are so behind the times in the pharmacy world of printing this out. And so while I don't think estrogen is not perfect, it got vilified in 100%, 100% the blame for breast cancer. And now, slowly but surely, we have learned estrogen single-handedly by itself is not the cause of breast cancer. Cancer is a complicated, multifaceted thing that happens in our body. And there are a lot of reasons and things that have to go wrong or build up or for us to develop cancer. Everything from genetics, and I don't even mean the BRCA gene, the BRCA gene, but I even mean like the way we detoxify, the way we handle estrogen, the way that we process these chemicals, to the chemicals that end up in our body and act like estrogen, to estrogen itself, et cetera, et cetera. And so I understand the fear, the frustration, the nervousness that a lot of women have around, I heard HRT causes cancer. Oh gosh, trying to sum that up in 5 minutes in a patient visit is very hard.
Right.
But we have come, I want people listening to know, like, oh my gosh, we have come such a long way. We have learned so much. A lot of those authors have actually come out with new studies, later studies to show quite the opposite, that the HRT wasn't causing those things. And in fact, can be really quite beneficial all around. And yeah, the WHI trial, good gracious, that it's a disservice, such a disservice to women.
Yeah.
Because, which we will talk about, I'm not necessarily an advocate for those forms of HRT, Premarin or Provera, the ethanol estradiol or progestin. However, I think it really plunged a lot of women the last couple decades into an awful menopause, metabolic syndrome, potentially dementia, Alzheimer's risk, osteoporosis. It just really wreaked havoc on women who had to go off their HRT.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And so when you talk about that study with people that were like in their 60s and had these cardiovascular risk factors and thinking about like the population that we put on HRT now, from my understanding, we should really be targeting women that have, we could start it as early as perimenopausal if we see those levels drop, but really like within that first 5 years of menopause is really like the golden place to see the outcomes as far as like bone, preserving bone mineral density and brain function and things like that. So what are your thoughts on like who, when you start that HRT?
Exactly what you said. So the sooner the better. One, you'll get the benefits. And two, as we know, as we get older and lose estrogen, you and I know, people listening may not know. So again, we are more at risk for metabolic issues, prediabetes, diabetes, insulin resistance. We are more at risk for cardiovascular stuff, atherosclerosis, things like that. If you have inflamed arteries, if your arteries are at atherosclerotic point, estradiol is actually, can actually make you a lot worse. And we have to be very careful at that point. Like I said, estrogen's not perfect, but it doesn't need to be as vilified. And that often happens with age, or our risk goes up for that with age. Mm-hmm. So if you are headed into menopause in your 40s or 50s, that is the ideal time. If you hem and haw and wait, and then you're suddenly you're 65 and you think, gosh, I am still having hot flashes, I still don't sleep well, I'm still having all these symptoms, I'm going to go ahead and talk about to my doctor about HRT. Then as you get older, we definitely give it a big old pause of, I don't know that you're a candidate as much as you were when you were younger. And a lot of the bone, brain, et cetera, changes, it's been, probably been 15 years, maybe even 20 if you're looking at this for at 65. And so by then I'm like, you're not going to get your bones back. Unfortunately, the degradation in your brain, we can do what we can with other ways, but it's not, estrogen is not a magic savior that's going to come in and patch it all back up again. So I agree with you 100%. Right. I think the younger, I joke to my friends, when my friends and I are all around the same age, our mid 40s, and I said, the minute we all need estrogen and progesterone, we are just, we're going to prescribe for each other. We are preserving as much as we can.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And so we could talk a little bit about the formulations. Like you mentioned, the formulations that we typically use are different than what was used in the Women Health Initiative. So we use bioidentical, which means that it's basically the same chemical that is found, or chemical structure found in the body. It may not be created from the body, but it is the same chemical structure. And so those can be given topically, orally, even vaginally for some patients. And so the one sort of nuance, or the nuances I see a lot of, there's actually a prescription product now that's oral estrogen and oral progesterone in a tablet that is bioidentical, which I'm like, yay, bioidentical, it's in a tablet. But we do see, and I believe it's a little bit of increased risk in clotting in patients with oral estrogen. Is that? So it's not, probably not the most ideal.
Yeah, I was going to say, not many practitioners that I know, conventional or functional, use oral estradiol, just flat out, period. Most, if they're going to use a prescription, they'll use the patches. You know, they'll use the DOT or something like that, which are also bioidentical. Yeah. And then they will add in the oral progesterone, known as Prometrian, if that's the route they're going to go. And I tend to follow that as well. I don't generally use oral estradiol, although I understand why. Given some research on it, I understand for the positive effects, I understand why people jump to the oral estradiol.
Yeah, and I feel most comfortable with the standardized forms of estradiol patches and things like you mentioned too, because we know the data is there for this level to cause, you know, increase by this much, et cetera. There's certainly compounding pharmacies that can like dial it in a little bit if you need less, especially in that perimenopausal phase, you may not need the full dose of estrogen. But I think there's just so many more factors in that, like what creams they used and where the patient puts it when they're rotating spots, and certainly can rub off on somebody else. And so they have to, there's lots of like potentials with the topicals, but I know a lot of practitioners are, I'm using topicals too in some patients, but I think sometimes it's okay. If cost is a concern, going with a more conventional like patch route might also be a better place because it's going to be covered on their insurance.
Yeah.
But then progesterone,
I was just going to say, I love that you said that because people will often ask me, just as I'm sure they ask you, Carrie, what's the best? What's the best form? And I'm like, or they'll say, my sister told me, or I read on social media that topical creams are the best. I'm like, except you're in your 40s and let's say you had children late in life. And so they you still snuggle with you in bed, you, or you read with them at night. And so they're all snuggled up against you. So you've got this cream on you, depending when you put it on and which one it is, you know, and it can transfer and it can transfer to your partner. I mean, it's these hormones are very, they're very fat soluble, yeah. meaning they will pick up very quickly through skin to skin contact. And the same goes for, you know, vaginal. Somebody will say, I've heard vaginal hormone is the best. I said, it depends what you, the outcome is, but you also don't want to use it as a lubrication. So if you are sexually active in any form, yeah. and you've inserted your hormone up there, then you have to be careful because your partner doesn't need or want yes. that hormone as well. And you have to be very careful. So then so some women are like, oh, that doesn't matter at all to me. And others are like, oh no, we are very active or very spontaneous. That won't work. I'm like, I'm asking all these questions as to what will work for your lifestyle. And then we can adjust from there as opposed to quote, what do I think is the best?
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great point. And I think a lot of times in a traditional medical office, those questions aren't necessarily being asked or the education isn't there to support. Okay, if you do go with the vaginal, here's the things you need to think about. Yeah. But then the progesterone standpoint, we know that like low progesterone, even in premenopausal women, and lack of progesterone or enough progesterone in the second half of the cycle has been associated with anxiety. So the cool thing is that oral progesterone actually breaks down into metabolites that cause a calming effect. So I love using oral progesterone in those women that are anxious and just see them be able to fall asleep and have better, because the better sleep, I had a lady that she was menopausal, type 2 diabetes, blood sugars out of control, but she was sleeping like 3 hours a night, 3 to 4 hours a night. And I was like, oh my goodness, like this is not going to work out. Your blood sugars are going to always be a train wreck if you're only sleeping 3 to 4 hours a night. And so I was like, let's talk about HRT. She was within that 5-year window, I think only 2 years out from her last period. So we started on oral progesterone, topical estrogen. She slept 7 to 8 hours a night within a couple of weeks. And it's just like amazing, like that they can all of us be able to transition and then blood sugars improve and all of that. So I had a patient that was a patient with type 2 diabetes, and she was only sleeping like 3 to 4 hours a night. And we were within like 2 years of her being in menopause. And so I said, if you're not able to fall asleep or calm down, and obviously the estrogen plays a role in the glucose, and her glucose was all over the place. So I thought, I talked to her about the benefits of HRT from that perspective. So we tried it. And so we did oral progesterone with the GABAergic effects from the progesterone metabolites. And then we also did a topical estrogen cream or estradiol cream. And she was sleeping like a baby within like a few weeks.
I love that.
So 7 to 8 hours of sleep after that. Yeah. So it's amazing. I won't say every single person has that exact picture, but when it happens, you're like, oh my goodness, yay. And then the blood sugar improvement, is it from the estrogen? Is it from the fact that you slept 7 to 8 hours a night and your body is actually able to like manage your cortisol response better? So I think there's just so many pieces of all of that fits together. But yeah, so speaking of pieces fitting together, let's talk a little bit about gut health and how important that is when we're talking about the Women's Health Initiative and the increased risk of breast cancer. One of the things is making sure that estrogen gets out of the body appropriately. And so talk to us a little bit about estrogen detox, because I think that's like a buzzword that everyone's talking about. And what are the keys there for women, especially women on HRT?
Yeah, and actually one of the things, I don't know why I didn't think of this, but I was at a conference in 2022, and one of the keynote speakers was talking about is women lose their estradiol, their entire gut microbiome shifts. You have estradiol receptors pretty much everywhere all over your GI tract as females, and males too, but her focus was females. And so she's like, as you move into menopause, the gut you had in a cycling woman is no longer the gut that you have. And I was like, who designed that? Who decided? That's terrible. But it also makes sense. And that as we move into menopause, our gut health is so important and tied to so many systemic symptoms. And so for those women who say, Carrie, I haven't changed anything, I'm like, but everything has changed internally and you just don't know it. You know it because you feel it, but you didn't do anything. You lost your estradiol and everything inside changed. So I thought that was super fascinating. So I've been really diving into what is changing when we lose our estradiol. And that goes with estrogen detoxification. So when we talk about detoxification, first of all, it happens 24/7, 365. Your body is detoxifying right now, every single day. It doesn't take a break for Christmas, Hanukkah, Sunday, your birthday. Detoxification is always happening, right? And you've learned that there are ways you expel stuff from your body. You sweat it out, you breathe it out, you pee it out, you bowel movements. With estrogen in particular, it goes through your liver predominantly, but it can go through other tissues in the body as a first step. And then it goes into your GI tract or it goes into your kidneys. So estrogen doesn't get breathed out or sweated out. So it's really important that we focus on our GI tract for estrogen. And I often refer to our GI tract as like our sewer line. It's the end of the line for getting estrogen out. So we have to make sure our GI tract is healthy. Do you have regular bowel movements? Do you have gas and bloating? Do you have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth? Do you have H. pylori, heartburn, GERD, et cetera? What is going on? Because that's going to negatively impact how you do or don't clear estrogen from your body, which then can negatively impact breast tissue, as an example.
Yeah. That what you said about the estrogen receptors in the gut, I wonder if that's part of the reason why estrogen can be more dangerous from an atherosclerotic standpoint in someone that has gone so many years without it, if then we're not just set up to be able to handle it like we were when we were having the constant exposure to estrogen. So I don't know if that's there's any research on that or not. But I would think if you're taking HRT that then your gut would still sort of look like
it does
a little bit more like your premenopausal days. Yeah, cool. And then who do we think is not a candidate for HRT? Is there anyone out there that shouldn't be taking? Certainly people that have had estrogen dependent cancers are probably off the list for HRT. But anyone else, if they have family history of estrogen dependent cancers, what are your conversations like with those women?
So I absolutely ask them those questions. Have you ever had an estrogen related cancer? Remember, it doesn't have to be breast. It could be uterine or cervical. There's other tissues that are estrogen related. Family history, but it's also how close. If somebody says, my great grandmother had it, or two aunties over had it, I'm like, nope, that isn't. But if your sister had it, mom and sister have had it, then I'm a lot more concerned. But I'm concerned in general. I'm not just necessarily concerned about estrogen. I'm like, what is it that we need to help affect, clean up, test that your family is prone to estrogen? And then again, I am cautious with cardiovascular disease. So if you're already coming to me at 40 years old, having had a stent put in, you're on all sorts of high blood pressure, high cholesterol type medications, beta block. If your cardiologist really has their thumb on you, I will probably talk to the cardiologist first to say, obviously I wouldn't do oral estrogen, but maybe we ease into it with progesterone. And then maybe we start with some DHEA or testosterone, and then we can determine what's going on with that estrogen.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good point. Yeah, because earlier and earlier, I think we see a lot of men that have cardiovascular disease early, but even women now in those 40s time frame, unfortunately, are seeing that as well. So if someone couldn't use HRT and they are, or maybe they're past the optimal time frame for HRT, what are sort of, I mean, besides the nutrition components we talked about, do you have any go-to nutrients or supplements that you like to use in those women?
Now, remember, when we talk about HRT, you and I are predominantly talking about estradiol and progesterone. You can still use progesterone, DHEA, testosterone in an older age. It's estradiol predominantly that we're talking about with getting that benefit early on. But if you're 65 and need DHEA or vaginal DHEA or vaginal testosterone or topical testosterone, progesterone for sleep, I'm okay with that for sure. So there are other methods of, or forms, I should say, of HRT hormones, definitely. And then I definitely, as if you, but let's say you can't use estrogen, what can you use? There are definitely some really nice herbal blends that help with adrenal. So those adrenal herbal adaptogens to help with stress management, herbs that can help estrogen receptors. You know, we see a lot like with black cohosh or hops or angelica that are supportive to help reduce the risk of hot flashes and night sweats. Making sure, again, as we're getting older, making sure we're getting our nutrients, our minerals. We're often very mineral deficient as we get older. Even things like our magnesium, like the most common. Make sure you're getting enough magnesium. And so by going back to the basics, what's your vitamin D look like? What do your B vitamins look like? These are all easily testable things. And I would hate to miss them because you're so focused on estrogen or not estrogen, but you're ragingly anemic or you're ragingly low in vitamin D. Let's address those things because, gosh, that can make a world of difference too.
For sure. Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us today, and tell our audience where they can find you.
Absolutely. You can find me on social media. I'm on Instagram at dr.carriejones or my website, www.drcarriejones.com, Or you, if you are a practitioner listening, rupahealth.com, and you can learn all about Rupa and lab work and even the other education and podcasts that I do there.
Awesome. Yes. And she is on the Root Cause Medicine podcast as well in iTunes and probably other places.
All the places.
So awesome. Yes. All the places. It would be nice if there's just one place, but I know no one talks to each other, just like the healthcare system. So many different avenues, but awesome. Thanks so much for joining us again. We really appreciate your time and have a good day.
Wonderful. Thank you.